You know ID in the town all day. ID in the SEA. You know ID in the town all day. ID in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 419 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we're coming to you from different locations. I'm in Seattle, Washington, home of the first place.
There it is.
Seattle Mariners.
There we go.
Came up so naturally.
Look, you shouldn't be that comfortable saying the first place Seattle Mariners. If you were comfortable saying it, the last 20 years wouldn't have happened.
It wouldn't be worth saying. Where are you coming from?
I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Someday we'll maybe talk about them on this podcast again.
The Seahawks, not today. Like, they are gone.
We've become a Mariners podcast. Storm podcast.
I mean, the Seahawks just aren't doing... They're not doing anything, but they're especially not doing interesting things.
Apparently, Ryan Grubb has half the offense, and so you got that going for you, which Great. Is nice. Sam Howell had a better OTA practice. And just call me in August. Maybe not even August. Maybe call me in September. We'll see. Well, I feel like this is almost an Oops All Rando podcast. We'll have some extended sections on the Mariners and Seahawks, but it's just like a lot of notes this week.
We're going to have an extended section on the Seahawks?
Or on the Storm, I should say.
I was like, but do the Storm not count as Roundup?
Again, I don't technically consider them Roundup.
It's very complicated what you consider Roundup and what isn't.
It is. It's fluid.
How much of the players getting the NCAA ruling conversation did you leave in the podcast last week?
Oh, none of it.
Okay, great.
I had questionable takes in there. Not anti-players getting paid, to be clear. I'm very pro that.
You're going to have to delete this also.
I made a questionable suggestion that college athletics would be better off reverting to a Division III model. That was, I immediately regretted the take. So it never saw the light of day. You can't hold me to it.
I don't even remember this take for what it's worth.
Okay, well, yeah, glad it was both bad and unmemorable.
I know, are we talking Husky football at all?
We do have some Husky football notes this week.
Okay, yeah, we'll talk about that later. But most importantly, my take is, it's pretty fun seeing a list of, I saw ESPN had their FPI projections. Is that what's in there?
That is a thing that is in there.
Okay. Just seeing it listed as Big Ten is like, wow.
It's coming. Yeah, it's coming. No more UW Pac-12 sports. I assume some Pac-12 teams are still alive in the NCAA baseball tournament. The softball, the Pac-12 has given up the ghost. It's an old Big 12 for the moment final between
Texas and Oklahoma. Yeah.
Oh, boy. All right, well, one toast this week, and it's a national championship one. Not really a Big Ten or Pac-12 thing, but congrats to UW Men's Crew on winning its 20th IRI Varsity 8 national title on Sunday in West Windsor, New Jersey. The Huskies swept the Varsity 8 second and third Varsity 8s, as well as Varsity 4, winning their 18th James 10 Ike Memorial Trophy for overall points champion.
You know what? That's actually a very fitting toast to be the last toast from the Conference of Champions.
There you go. I mean, the conference affiliation actually does not matter whatsoever in
from
crew.
Conference of Champions. We talked about Bill Walton last week. Let's have this one.
All right. That's fair. That's all I have for toasts. We do not have a stop in our search for Seattle's best cookie this week. We'll resume it next week.
Or not.
No, we're not abandoning the search. I want to be very clear.
I've got a lot more cookies to eat here, people.
We're not abandoning the search. I just didn't drive over to Tristan's house tonight, so there was no good opportunity for us to do cookies.
Did you get cookies and then not drive over, or did you just know that you weren't going to?
I knew that I wasn't going to drive over. So I did not get cookies.
What are some? Can we talk about our search for Seattle's best cookie? What are some cookies that are left?
We're
talking big ones.
So it's interesting. I went and looked at it today, and there was one of the places on the list that was one of the like most available ones, and it turned out their protein cookies And it seems like it's the I have some questions about how the protein supplements that are in there. So I went ahead and took that one off the
Okay.
list.
All right.
That
Goodbye to
was
the protein cookie
Dip
cookie
Bank
place.
Seattle, which is located during the market. So there's like a couple of them that are like strictly Friday pickup only
Okay.
that
You know
are.
that the Pelican Cast loves a complicated food
Oh,
to get.
we do. We
The
do.
more complicated, the better.
It harkens back to when you acquired what's the Windy City
Windy City,
Pie.
yeah.
Yeah.
But back when Windy City Pie used to be hard to get.
It was like you had to like arrange a pickup with the Windy City Pie plug on the streets.
Yeah, that was awesome. Also, it was in like I guess Soto area is what you would describe it as. And you know that anything that is anywhere near the greater South Seattle area, we're excited about food wise. If you could
100%.
have a pairing of complicated food to get plus greater South Seattle area, we are in.
Wow. Anyways, that's Coping Cookies in Capitol Hill and Cookie Break in Montlake are both were both Friday pickup only, the last I looked at it. There's also Cookies with Tiffany, which is a place I've been before, which is only open Thursday through
But now,
Saturday.
is that named after the Deep Blue Something song?
No.
Okay.
It's named after the proprietor, whose name is Tiffany.
Oh, okay.
We want to do De Laurenti in the market.
Okay. I don't think I've ever had, that's like a classic cookie, right?
Yes.
I
No,
don't
I've
think
never
I've
had it
ever
either.
had
Yeah.
De Laurenti cookies.
Hot cakes is still on the list.
Oh, hotcakes as cookies? I guess I.
Yeah, we've talked about this before for sure. In fact, I'm
Okay.
pretty sure I've archived audio of it going back and listening to our first cookie search. We talked about it.
Is it like one big warm cookie?
Well, you can buy their cookies to go, I think, but they do
Okay.
serve it warm, is my
Okay.
recollection. I've had this once, but it was a long time ago. Seawolf, I visited, but you'll recall they did not have their signature cookies
Got it.
available,
Okay.
so we've paused on that one. And then lastly, I mean, this is not really eligible for Seattle's best cookie, but one we definitely are going to talk about, the Schwartz Brothers cookies at Taco Time.
Okay.
We're enlisting the full Talkin' Taco Time
I was
crew
gonna
for that
say maybe
one.
we should invite some special guests for that one.
The invitation was extended. Like they couldn't do it tonight. That's
Rejected.
part of the reason we do not have a cookies search today. So
Oh.
we're kind of down to it, I would say. There's still some. I'm very intrigued to the Coping Cookies and Cookie Break seem very new,
You're intrigued
to
by
the
those
market.
because of the complication of getting them?
Yes,
Yeah, me
precisely.
too. Me too.
I mean, obviously.
You had me at one day a week. Have to only take out? Yes.
Obviously, I'm excited to try De Laurenti.
Yeah.
Say what up to Quinn Snyder's brother who runs De Laurenti.
Really? Does he owns De Laurenti?
I believe possibly co-owner, but he's definitely involved. Yeah.
Oh God, we talked last week about how you're in the pocket of Big Utah. So
It's Quinn Snyder is no longer in the pocket of Big Utah, as it
was
turns
he the
out.
Hawks
He
coach?
is
Is
coaching
that
the
right?
Atlanta
There we
Hawks,
go.
yes.
Okay.
I don't know what this reminded me of it, but Seattle area to Duke. Shout out to Paolo Banchero, who is courtside with his mother, WNBA legend Rhonda Smith Banchero, at last night's Storm game. And I said this to the group chat that the photo that the Storm posted on their socials of Paolo, because he was like directly in front of me, you can see me in the background.
Oh,
Yo, you
I
didn't
didn't
get
get that.
that
I
why
thought
I
you were
said that
talking
it was.
about Paolo and his mom. We're
Well,
two of. And I was like, that's kind of funny.
Rhonda's a Seattle basketball legend. She is not an Italian American Seattle
That's
basketball
I thought
legend.
that was the joke was like just because her last name was Italian. Okay, hold on, hold on. I have to
You're having
consult
to
the
pull it up to
videotape. I
look.
really am.
It's so funny. I saw Infrared reposted this on Instagram. He didn't seem to take notice of it that I could
Two of
tell.
Seattle's most. Oh, you're well, you love finding yourself in the background of photos.
You're damn right I do. One of my favorite pastimes.
That's really funny. Okay. How did you,
Thank you.
this is the problem with you not having Twitter. You couldn't post stuff like two of Seattle's most prominent Italians.
I mean, I did post it on Discord. I did not post that particular caption.
Oh, you didn't?
No, I refrained.
You should have screen capped it like just like that, where you could see yourself and Paolo.
Maybe I'll do it that way when I post this in the post notes. All right, so there we are. That's resetting our search for Seattle's best cookies.
I'm excited. Okay.
Or cookie. Still to be determined. Maybe both.
Can we do one of the Friday ones this Friday? It's supposed to be sunny. I feel like cookies will taste great.
Are you going to be available to connect with me to receive these cookies?
I'm always available.
All right, let's do it then.
Wow, okay.
You had me and it's going to be sunny.
Did you not know that?
No, I was aware. I'm just saying, I'm excited. With that, it's time for Coach's Corner.
This is the last Coach's Corner for a while, I assume. So I mentioned before, Mateo, his football season was ended with the broken arm. But honestly, it was a little bit Coach's Corner for him as well, helping out. But the NFL flag or whatever Super Bowl was on Sunday. Bills Ravens in the championship of NFL flag. And you know that nothing bad ever happens to the Bills in a championship game. But so it is pouring rain, right? This game is happening at the very beginning of an atmospheric river at Renton Memorial Stadium where champions are crowned. We're there warming up for an hour or whatever. Team is looking good. We're feeling confident. We're scouting the Ravens a little bit, watching their plays. The coach of the Raven has the wristband with plays on it, which I'm not going to lie. After seeing their play calls, I don't know if it was necessary, but intimidation wise, I will say it worked. So that's a little note for us for the future. If we're trying to intimidate the other team, having the wristband with plays.
Look, you're always competing.
An intimidation 1000. So we're warming up. There's like a full hour of practice before the game. And then I see the referees walk into the field. And normally they're like 16-year-olds half paying attention. Like you'll talk to them and there'll be a penalty and he'll be like, it's whatever. You know what I mean? Like one person will call a penalty and the other person will be like, no. And then they're just like, it doesn't matter. Like they could not care less as the referees of these games for the most part. For the Super Bowl though, in walks, I saw it and I was like, oh shit. They brought out the big guns. This dude walks in like 6'2", buff as hell, graying beard. He was the most professional looking flag football referee I have ever seen. It was like Ed Hockley had walked onto the field for this flag football championship game. And you knew that motherfucker meant business right away. He gets everybody out there. He's organized. He's calling the coin toss. He's like, this is how we do things around here. He was making sure that everybody was lined up. So anyway, they get the ball. Mateo goes out there, loses the coin toss for what it's worth. The Ravens, you know that this team is on it because they defer to the second half. Oh, yeah. No, this is the Super Bowl. We're not fucking around here. And they defer to the second half.
Did they actually refer to it as the Super Bowl?
No, I don't think so. They just play the top teams. But we referred to it as the Super Bowl.
It really seems like it was more the AFC championship game in this case. But, yeah.
But so we know that things are going to be serious with Ed Hockley, our ref. And so first series of the game, you could see competition is stiff, right? We're grinding, getting first downs a little bit, but the offense isn't working as well as we want it to. Get down. Fourth down happens from the 18 or whatever. Quarterback throws a bomb. Receiver comes up with it, diving catch in his hands. We're elated. Flag is on the field.
Oh, wow.
The quarterback crossed the line of scrimmage for the pass. A penalty we have not seen all year. And I assure you that quarterbacks have crossed the line of scrimmage previously. It is like a half inch past the line of scrimmage. But this referee is not letting anything fly. Tears are streaming all over the place for these children. He does not care. And the rest of the game was the most pristinely called flag football game I have ever seen in my entire life. If there's a flag that like the coaches will be like, that should have been a flag or whatever, flag guarding, boom, that flag is out before we can even complain about it. There were so many passes from beyond the line of scrimmage that happened in the game. It was obscene how many were called. And the one kid who's the best starting quarterback, I'm like, you got to take a few steps back. Once you get the snap or whatever, just take a few steps back because you're crossing the line of scrimmage every single play. There were three or four of those that were called. So we're grinding down. I think it was 12-0 at halftime. Team comes
very
back.
Bills Ravens kind of scored.
Well, the team comes back in the second half. Halftime, the coach is like, there's an offensive coordinator and defensive coordinator. He comes up to me and he's like, what do you think we should do? And I'm like, RPOs every play. Bam, RPO, touchdown. Bam, RPO, touchdown. They finally started figuring it out. And the play became less unstoppable after that. So they're up 14-12. There's like 4 minutes left. And the Ravens, their playbook is not that complicated. It is the mildest misdirection. And we're just like, just stay with the ball. Like, don't run with the player. Find the ball. Stay with the ball. That's what you need to do. And that misdirection is getting us. And then, boom, they hit us. Basically, the only completed pass of the game when we're up 14-12. A bomb for a touchdown. They go up 19-14 on that play. We get the ball back. 2 minutes left in the game with basically one possession to try to score. Come down, first down, gain a few yards. Second down, gain a few yards, trying to get to the 20 for a first down. Third down, quarterback, pass line of scrimmage, of course. Fourth down, Hail Mary, just trying to even pick up a first down. Incomplete. Tears are... Mateo didn't even participate in the game. Devastated. He's crying hysterically. Another player has ripped off his flags, facing the wrong direction. We did not handle it well. And
Those are your guys.
It was like it was wide right number three for us. So
you know the wide right one and two, that was a Miami Florida State thing, not Buffalo.
Oh,
Bills.
Wait, was it? Wait.
Yeah.
Oh. I thought it was Scott Norwood.
Scott Norwood was also, I think, wide right, but the reason you're thinking of one and two is because of consecutive Miami that. Florida State games in the
early
90s.
All right, fair enough. But we did not handle it well. There were many tears shed, and sadly, the Bills went down in the Super Bowl. I told Mateo, I was like, this was because you weren't out there. Like, it wasn't a fair fight. We needed offense desperately, and he wasn't there, and he wouldn't have crossed the line of scrimmage as a quarterback. So I'm not blaming the other players. Everybody tried their hardest. But for him, I told him, the problem was, you know, he's an Eagles fan, obviously. I was like, you're like Carson Wentz. But the problem was, the Eagles won that Super Bowl. So, which he is, most children wouldn't be smart enough to know this information, but he's like, they still won, Dad. And it's like, he'd rather be Nick Foles than Carson Wentz in this situation.
I'd rather be Nick Foles than Carson Wentz in most situations.
Was it Navarro Bowman who was running out on the field who hurt himself during the Super Bowl this year?
No.
Who was it? There was a linebacker for the Niners who was running out on the field and just tore his ACL or whatever.
Navarro Bowman is long retired.
Okay. Who am I thinking of? Star linebacker for the Niners.
Yeah, I can't think of it off the top of my head either. It feels like
we are so out of football right now.
We are very out of football. People are just yelling at their monitors.
Was it Dre Greenlaw?
Okay, that sounds right. I was like, but Navarro Bowman, it was not him. Suffice to say.
He tore his Achilles. Dre Greenlaw tore his Achilles running onto the field. And I'm like, that's like what it was like for you. Like, you just weren't able to be out there in this one. They would have won otherwise. But the Carson Wentz comparison was not well received. Cried hysterically.
Well, look, you know, if you're emotionally invested, there's going to be some disappointment when you fall short. Your discussion of the refereeing in this reminds me, so an extension of the conversation last week about the Puget Sound Basketball League incident. Griffin Pulliam, I'm pretty sure I got it that time.
There we go.
Went into further depth about some ejections that happened for his Puget Sound Basketball League team.
Really?
And he has like the score books because he took photos of all of them with his team so that he could have everybody pay him for the games that they played in. He made very clear that game was being refereed by Masvita Marer of Cascades Sportsnet, who is one of my good friends. And I am almost positive that Maz, who I knew a little bit back then because he was on press row for the Sonics as well, was refereeing and was the one who gave you the technical
really
for your play or your flagrant or whatever it was.
Was Maz tech happy?
No, I don't think so. I mean, we agreed with him. Everyone agreed with his decision.
I
There
was
was
in the
no
wrong.
controversy with mine. But it's just very funny that now this is someone that I see at like basically every Storm game. So,
Honestly, I will say the refereeing was intimidating, but just having a pristinely reffed game was great.
I mean, it
There
is
was a
kind of
play,
cool. It feels befitting of the Super Bowl.
the flags, like sometimes your flag is in front and that's like against the rules. They have to be on the side or whatever. Mid play, our coach is like, his flag is in front. The referee lets the play happen. After the play, comes and talks to the coach and he's like, "Hey, coach, I just want to let you know my policy if the flags are in front." And then explain, he was like, "My policy is the second if that player gets the ball, the second somebody reaches for it, the play is dead right after that." And I'm like, wow, he heard the complaint, clocked it, waited for the play to be finished, came over and gave a clear explanation that we were all like, all right, that seems fair.
I think I might want to have him on the podcast as part of
he was
Coach's
no,
Corner.
I don't know if he'd be a fun person to have on the podcast.
It's okay. You could be the straight man and we could play off him.
I feel like somebody else must have encountered this person at some point, right? Like, there's like some like famed children's baseball umpires that everybody knows. It's like Ump Tony's Awards and stuff. Dude has to be known outside of this. Other people have to have had him because this man has refereed some flag football games before and he has taken it seriously.
I feel like the Pelton Kest demographic is more having played in the games than having their children played in the games. Not that
I
no
don't know
one
if
has
I agree
kids,
with
but
that.
they're not necessarily that age.
You think I have the
So
oldest children of any Pelton
that's
Caspers?
what I'm telling you, yes.
Wow.
But if you do know, please let us know. PeltonCast@gmail.com or the Discord. I wanted to touch on this quickly because it also came up on the Discord. So the NBA's new national TV deals appear based on the reporting to be nearing completion. And that would complete the checklist that was new CBA, new TV deals. Then we start talking about expansion. So people were wondering, like, hey, what's that process going to look like, basically? And to lay it out in the most general terms, what would probably happen is that the Board of Governors, which is the 30 primary owners of the current teams, will likely approve the idea of expansion or approve two expansion teams. And then they would put together a committee to take bids, possibly multiple bids, but cities and possibly ownership groups within those cities. So it's not like they're going to say, hey, we're expanding to Seattle and Las Vegas right away. The NBA would say, hey, we're expanding. And then they would hear out Louisville and Mexico City and, the Virginia Beach area, all these places that are interested in an NBA team. And then from those, they would select two teams and possibly at that same time, ownership groups. And that's when you would have potentially the announcement that the Sonics are back.
How public will that information be made? Is this going to be extraordinarily public the entire way?
I mean, I think it'll be widely reported. I don't think they're going to necessarily be super transparent about like, here's the eight bids we received, but
But it'll be like the NBA has made a committee to receive bids.
yeah, I think they would acknowledge that publicly.
Okay. And then, as the bids are happening, so we'll be fairly aware of this process. The actual maybe announcement might come as a surprise, or
I
there
would
might
be
be.
surprised if it comes as a surprise.
We
These
might not know the
things are hard to keep
exact
secret.
day that it's going to be announced. Like it'll be something where it. So you're telling me that this. When does this process start? I guess what is the inflection point? Right now, like what ignites this conversation
Well,
now that these deals are done?
the wild card that is still the city out there is the possibility of litigation surrounding the match rights for the existing TV partners in the contracts. And specifically, therefore, for Turner Sports.
That Turner Sports may have negotiated matching rights
They
on this.
it is widely reported that they have matching rights, but what exactly it means to match an offer from if NBC is trying to put games on Peacock, for example, or what it means to match an offer by Amazon, which is streaming only if you're a linear television network. That's the technicality that may take some time to sort out.
But so that's still the first piece. So basically, the timeline is those things need to be figured out first.
Yes.
And then once that happens, we'll probably know when those things are done, right? Yes. When the TV deals are signed, we'll know. Is it immediately after that? Or is it?
Tough to say. So I guess the one thing I can tell you is the kind of the schedule for the Board of Governors.
Yes.
They typically meet in July at the Summer League, in October before the start of the season. And then okay. I believe it's in April is their other meeting within the season. So hypothetically, that July Summer League meeting would be the very earliest, if everything was resolved, they could take up the question of expansion.
So fastest scenario, the TV deals get, I mean, they're figured out, right? The only thing that is right now being negotiated are these match rights.
That's how it appears.
July, it happens. Let's say that conversation is settled. July, they could be like, okay, these are done. Now let's open up the conversation to a committee. Is there a chance that they've viewed bids by October? Or does that seem too fast?
I think that's probably a little fast, I would say. And some of this depends on how soon they're thinking about these teams beginning to play. You know, is it 2026? If so, then yeah, you'd probably need to be getting this turned around pretty quickly. If it's 2027, there's not the same sort of rush.
Or has it been reported if there is an influx of cash from the TV deals? Like, if they negotiated into these deals that they will increase if they add extra teams, a la like
that has not been reported.
College conferences have. That has not been reported at all. Do we think that means that they're not in there, or that maybe just hasn't been reported yet?
I don't know on that one.
Okay. Because that was something that we saw with, say, the Big Ten deal or an SEC deal, is if you add teams, the fee will be X amount more, knowing that that was a thing that could happen, whether it was done or not. So I suppose if you're somebody who, or for wanting expansion, it would have been better had we heard that specifically.
Yes, although I don't think anyone has raised any specific questions about the viability of expansion.
Let's say that those deals remain static. Do the owners then carve up that pie further for the new teams? Or
eventually, although it's possible, like one of the things we saw when Chris Hansen was attempting to buy the Kings is that he volunteered to not take a share of the TV deal for, I think it was like 5 years.
Similar. So. It's similar to like a Cal Stanford joining the ACC situation.
Right.
Where you
just want to be in.
You got to be in, and then you'll figure everything else out later. Yes. Or, I mean, you'd have an Oregon joining the Big Ten and taking a smaller share than the new teams. Is it worth it then? It's worth it to be in for whatever billionaire is buying the team. It's almost irrelevant. It's a little bit of that piece that you're talking about. I understand these people are thinking long-term. Anytime that an institution like a sports franchise or a college says that they can't, that they're losing money, just remind yourself that these institutions are willing to pay whatever it'll be. Is it $1 billion for expansion fee? Something like that? Multiple billion-dollar expansion fee?
What will the fee be for an NBA expansion team?
Yeah.
It will be multiple billions, yes. Many billions.
So any time that somebody says that they are losing money as a sports franchise, the fact that an owner is willing to pay multiple $1 billion just to be in and then also possibly not get a piece of the largest revenue stream shows you that nobody is losing money here. I believe
someone I know once said the money is endless.
Oh, it is endless. And that's what I'm illustrating, is the reason that you know the money is endless is because all of these institutions show us with their actions that the money is endless. They say with their words differently, but they show us with their actions.
I will say that an NBA franchise in Seattle or even in Las Vegas is a lot more valuable than one in, say, Oklahoma City. Mm-hmm. So there is that element to things.
Should figure out whoever moved a team there. That seems like a really bad decision.
So
that actually doesn't matter, because it's not about, I agree that a team is worth more in these places, but they're not buying in for the purpose of reselling the team later. Does that make sense?
Like, I think that's part of why the the price is so high because you know you can sell it for a really high price in the future.
Yes.
So.
But also, if you have the billions of dollars to do all these things, you're not strictly looking at it like that. I don't think people are strictly looking at it as investment. It's to compete with the other billionaires that you hate. Is that not true?
I don't know if that's exactly how I would put it, but yes.
It's a factor. So do we think, I guess, just reading the tea leaves, if you had to put, knowing that this is all speculative, if you had to put timing on it, at what point do you think we'll get that news that the NBA, assuming this is going to happen, that the NBA has commissioned a group to explore or to receive bids for expansion?
I think it's realistic that that could happen before the next NBA season.
That the committee has been made to receive bids before the next, or we have news that that has happened before the next NBA season. So you think October is probably like...
I think that's reasonable. Yeah.
Okay. If that happens, what is the timeline after that?
I don't know. I don't remember, you know, because Charlotte was not an open kind of solicitation. It was just like, we're putting a team in Charlotte. And I don't really like, so it's been 30 years, you know, basically since they've done an open expansion. Why? I don't know why you find that so funny.
It's been a long time.
So there's not like a lot of precedent. Exactly.
I was thinking about it in terms of Mariner seasons.
Every Mariners playoff berth has happened since the NBA last expanded. I mean, technically Vancouver and Toronto hadn't played a game.
Every Mariners playoff berth has happened
since the NBA announced their expansion to Vancouver and Toronto. Since then, every Mariners playoff berth.
That's great. They're on fire.
And think about how few times the Vancouver Grizzlies have made it over that span.
Wow. That's not kind.
I bring back the Grizzlies. You know, if we're up to me.
Too soon.
You know, if we're up to me, the expansion would be to Vancouver and to Seattle. And then if they're going to add a third team, let's put one in Tacoma. Let's really get that I-5 rivalry going.
Is Vancouver in conversation at all?
Not prominently right now. I mean, I would imagine that they would bid in this scenario, but
do you feel like it's Seattle and Vegas right now? If you had to percentage odds, if you had to pick two teams,
I think they are the heavy favorites.
Are there any other sort of dark horse cities that you think?
Mexico City would be the only one.
You think it's between those three?
Yes.
I mean, Mexico City, obviously some complications, but there are just a lot of teams already in the places that, you know, the Kansas Cities and Virginia Beach. Like, there's, if you look at a map of the United States, the place that isn't, Seattle is the most obvious place that isn't represented, especially if you look at population centers. But I do think Vancouver, I mean, I guess not United States, North America, I suppose, but like, Vancouver is the other city that makes the most sense to me.
I think Vancouver would crush. I mean, it's such a different city than it was when the Grizzlies moved away. The arena would probably be the biggest impediment, because I don't think it's fascinating, because all three Northwest cities built arenas that opened in 1995.
Rogers Center opened in 1995?
I believe that one's Rogers Arena, right?
Rogers Arena, okay.
Rogers Center was what Skydome became at one point. Am I remembering this correctly?
Okay.
That's another confusing thing in Canada. All the arenas are named after Rogers. Yes, Rogers Center is the former Skydome.
But so Rogers Arena, that's where the Knucks play though, right?
The Rogers Arena, so like relatively, like Moda Center, which they're still renovating right now, like far and away number one. I haven't been in Rogers for a while. Pretty distant number two. I think I was last there in 2019 when Kawhi Leonard made his debut for the Clippers in Vancouver. And then Key Arena was somehow way below Rogers Arena and now obviously no longer exists. So That I think would be the biggest complication right now. But fan base wise, oh, the return of the Grizzlies would crush.
I totally agree. I think Vancouver would love an NBA team. I think, I don't know, Toronto does fairly well, all things considered, right?
Yeah. And now getting the WNBA.
Really?
Yeah, you missed that announcement?
Yeah, I think I missed that announcement. I don't. I might remember. I just don't.
Toronto's coming online in the WNBA in 2026 as the 14th franchise.
Just Toronto?
Yeah, because they're matching the Bay Area, the Golden State Valkyries, who will begin play next
season. The Valkyries?
You're just missing out on a lot of WNBA expansion news.
I'm here for it.
I need to be pointing it out on the pod.
You messaged me one time about the Storm playing, and I turned it on. And then you didn't message again after that.
Well, sorry, I was a little busy being at the game on Tuesday.
I guess I could have figured it out with your Paolo Banchero, but I didn't know you were in the background.
You didn't know what Paolo Banchero was courtside at. All right, that's enough on this. Let's get to your favorite segment.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at ya.
I kind of stopped writing this halfway through, so we're gonna see. I'm gonna wing it for the second half. As the first place Seattle Mariners sit 4.5 games up in the AL West, their widest margin since the year I graduated high school and I'm past my 20-year reunion, and 7 games above 500. I've got a message for the haters. I can't hear you. This team is 7 games above 500 and hasn't even played well yet. They're a second half team with a nice first half lead, and a Julio who hasn't even been engaged, and Luis Castillo with more losses than wins. By basically any measure, this season has greatly exceeded expectations. And there were those haters over the offseason. I don't know who they were, who criticized the plan. But if you look at how all of the ex-Mariners are playing, aside from Teoscar, the Mariners were right. You don't even want to look at Eugenio Suarez's stats right now. Kelenic is playing badly. Cobbie is fine. But the team is not, the players are not playing anywhere near what they would have been expected to based upon their past. They were right. And also, if you look at how all of the big free agency signings who the Mariners could have hypothetically signed, the Mariners were right. There's Blake Snell with his 9-plus ERA. Even Cody Bellinger, who signed a short deal, is getting paid $27 million for worse WAR than Luke Raley right now. The Mariners maintain their flexibility this offseason and have a better team to show for it. They're able to have a player like Jorge Polanco, who's out of the lineup, and we don't even miss him. And that is the positive of this team, that they have 100% flexibility right now to make any moves that they want to make going into the deadline long-term with Julio and be way up in first. And you know how little I like to say it, but so far, 60 games into the year, the Mariners front office was right.
Wow. A Mariners front office is right take on the same night that the Mariners have no base runners in the first 6 innings of a game against the Oakland A's, and a pitcher that I have definitely heard of named Joey Yestas.
He made his major league debut against the Mariners, Joey Yestas?
That seems plausible.
He pitched against them earlier this year.
Let's see. Two games in 2023.
He definitely pitched against them earlier.
And his first one was against the Seattle Mariners. Went 4 2/3, gave up 6 earned runs.
This year or last year?
That was last year.
I remembered that Joey Yestas made his major league debut against the Mariners last year.
Look, we're all shocked.
Close up shop.
Should we talk about the Brant Brown news? On Friday, the Mariners fired their bench coach and offensive coordinator barely 2 months into his tenure with the organization, Scott Service said afterwards that they want hitters focused, quote, on doing what they do best and more individualized instruction than they were getting under Brant Brown. And this is definitely like a scapegoat for the team's strikeout woes. But on the other hand, if all you prioritize over the offseason is bringing in guys who strike out less, and all the guys you brought in struck out more than they ever did before, it does seem like a troubling indicator.
I don't think there is anybody out there who was fighting for Brant Brown. And so I think that's probably right. The offense has been probably slightly worse than they should have been. I question how much an offensive coordinator, that's apparently the term now, coach.
There was a newly created position for the Mariners who previously had the standard hitting coach.
It almost makes me think that Brant Brown demanded to be called offensive coordinator, which makes me kind of dislike Brant Brown. But like, how much you could be telling
a
hitter?
He didn't call a single RPO all season.
For me, I'm like, RPOs, honestly, the last drive we got away from the RPOs.
Although, what is a hit and run if not in
an RPO?
RPO?
Yeah. Oh, it's an RHO. I'm skeptical how much a hitting coach actually, like, these are all, for the most part, the hitters who are striking out a lot are long-term veteran hitters. Like, I don't think that Brant Brown got into Mitch Garver's head and just made Mitch Garver not know how to hit. I think it's probably more just the cold weather affects players in Seattle. Like, again, I looked at the Mariners stats June 5th. The last 3 years, they finished pretty well above 500, 3 years in a row. And the Mariners on June 5th have either been in the last three below 500 or slightly below 500. The Mariners being seven games above 500 is way better than they've been at any point for the last three seasons where they have been successful. And I do question, I think that things probably would have turned around offensively irrelevant of Brant Brown, but if they know what's going on in the clubhouse, obviously more than we do from the outside, and there's nothing from the outside that suggests that Brant Brown is doing anything well. So, you know, the fire fast, hire slow thing. And I think it probably makes sense. And the team seems to be hitting at least slightly better.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't hurt that they have subsequently faced the Angels and the A's after an extraordinarily difficult stretch of their schedule. But
do you know how I know is probably keenly aware of that information?
Scott Service?
Brant Brown, that's who.
Let's see here. They have struck out seven
times. I think that
times.
Brant Brown also maybe just took a peek at the box score tonight.
Oh,
was
no.
Like,
oh, no. Brant Brown somewhere sitting there angrily.
You know he did. I guarantee you. He texted a friend or something. He just screen capped that. He screen capped the box score and sent it to a friend or whatever, his wife or something. And Brant Brown was like, Brant Brown was right.
Brant Brown was robbed. I believe, including tonight, the Mariners have 15 games this season where they have struck out seven times or fewer. One, two, three, four of them have already occurred during the 4 days they have played so far in May. And May 31st was in there as well.
I just can't imagine Brant Brown's like, swing for the fences, boys.
I think it was more about like being too disciplined instead of being aggressive coming to the plate is some of the other things that Scott Service is talking about. Which is weird because the Mariners weren't like especially good at drawing walks either. Yes, the Mariners got a lot of strikeouts, but they also didn't walk that often.
Do you remember Brant Brown as a player?
As a player?
At
a little
all?
Bit, yeah.
Okay.
I remember him from his Cubs days where he overlapped with Scott Service.
Oh, okay. That's how they knew each other?
Yes.
Ugh.
All right, some other Mariners news.
Fair enough. Another Nepo hire, Brant Brown.
When will people stop hiring Brant Brown just on the strength of his time with the late 1990s Cubs? Maybe early 2000s, I don't know. It all bleeds together at this point. The Mariners signed outfielder Victor Robles, who was waived by the Washington Nationals over the weekend and sent Jonathan Clase back to AAA. Robles is a native of the Dominican Republic who was ranked as high as the number 5 overall prospect before reaching the major leagues for good in 2019 at age 22. He finished 6th in Rookie of the Year voting that season, was a finalist for Gold Glove, but that was the high water mark for his career thus far. He slashed a combined 216, 291, 306 across the 2020 through 2022
seasons. That
sounds
like a Mariner.
It does. And then missed much of last season due to lumbar spine spasms. He, with Washington this season, was 3-for-25 with no extra base hits. So,
but we'll always remember the grounded into double play to end his first game as a Mariner.
Yeah. Yeah. That's about right. Well, I think Robles, if you think of him more as a defensive specialist and
footnote in history, because that's how we're going to think of him.
I miss Sam Haggerty already. Andres Munoz left Tuesday's win after aggravating a lower back strain that he later said he suffered in the second game of the season on a play at the plate. He said he is out for a couple of days, but hopefully not much more longer than that, as he told reporters Wednesday that they've been doing a good job of managing this injury and hope that they can continue to do so and allowing him to pitch through it. Definitely was a nervy ninth inning as I was watching it during Noel Quinn's press conference after the Storm game.
Like on your phone?
No, like it's on the screens in there in the media room. But Taylor Salcedo came through in the end.
Yes, he did.
John Stanton spoke to the Seattle Times recently, most notably said, quote, the loss of revenue from Root.
He was right.
Didn't say that. The loss of revenue from Root isn't the reason we've made any decisions over the last couple of years. So your mileage may vary on the veracity of that statement related to the Mariners payroll in the 2023 offseason. But he said that the front office will be positioned to have the resources to go out and make deals before the deadline.
The resources being minor league players.
Yes, exactly. good enough prospects that the other teams will pay the salaries of their players for the remainder of the year.
It's like we've given them a whole minor league. You got to pay those guys too.
We've got to pay them minimum wage now. They're even making us, So I don't really care about what John Stanton says. I like that he's speaking to the media. I think that's a positive, but I also don't really care what he has to say. We'll see
if it is a positive.
As long as he's not saying anything like Kevin Matherish, I think it's a positive.
Sure. Everything's a positive. The only speaking that's going to matter is through their actions, exactly. Not their words. And whatever they say, like the thing about Root Sports, we know what they think about their payroll based upon the actions that they've made. But at the same time, baseball is an extraordinarily complicated sport to assemble a roster if you aren't one of. And I do think it is a reasonable thing for John Stan to argue. Not that they're not a major market team, but that they're not going to be competing salary-wise with, say, the Dodgers and the Yankees. Yeah. That is a fine thing to say, because that is a truth that cannot be changed. But spending more in free agency doesn't necessarily correlate to success in Major League Baseball. I'm sure that if you look at it on like a great enough scale, it does. But when you look at these offseason signings, just a lot of players when they reach free agency are old. You know, the whole thing is structured to manipulate all of your successful years as a baseball player.
Gotta love that sweet, sweet team control.
So, I mean, the places to spend in baseball are not necessarily in free agency. It's about developing those resources when they're young players to be able to trade them for a Juan Soto and then be able to extend a player like Juan Soto. They didn't do that, but
Mariners playoff odds at Fangraphs, 73%, 63% to win the AL West.
Fangraphs still loves the Astros.
That's true, despite them being
at
seven
some
games
point,
out.
Fangraphs, he's not that into you.
I mean, in fairness, it's not like they have I mean, I guess 5.53 winning percentage, which is better than the Mariners the rest of the way. And still finishing with only 83 wins on average.
Well, yeah, they kind of keep losing games.
That's true. Well, you know who doesn't keep losing games? The Coachella Valley Firebirds.
Hello! I had no idea it was coming, to be
Our
honest.
favorite team. Calder Cup playoffs update. The Firebirds and new Kraken coach Dan Bylsma lead the Western Conference final 3-0.
There we
They
go.
held the Milwaukee Admirals to just two combined goals in two games at home, then broke out the offense to win game three 5-2 in Milwaukee on Tuesday night. Game four of that series is Thursday. The Firebirds have the chance to complete the sweep. All right, Seattle Sounders, another draw that felt like a loss last Wednesday at home. They took the lead against Real Salt Lake in the 68th minute with Albert Rusnak scoring against his former team on a deep free kick. Looked to go up two in stoppage time when Nanni Moskovski, also going against his former team, finished a break led by Reid Baker-Whiting. But the goal was disallowed by VAR
Oh.
for a foul committed by Moskovski as the Sounders took possession. It was during before this review that I left the room, and then I heard RSL getting the equalizing goal through Andres Gomez in the 98th minute. And was very confused and did not understand what was happening. I would thought
The
that Real Salt Lake had
98th
scored.
minute.
Well, there was a long VAR
Okay, fair
review.
enough. All right, fine, fine.
I mean, it was honestly a fair result as Real Salt Lake outpaced the Sounders in XG and the back line kind of struggled all night long. But another disappointment for the Sounders at home. They win by Portland over the weekend, dropped the Sounders out of playoff position in the West, but they just still have a match in hand on the Timbers. Good chance to pick up road points this weekend at Sporting Kansas City, tied for last in the West with 11 points from 16 matches. Sporting KC's -7 goal differential isn't so awful, but they are just 1-4-3 at home. Some other MLS news with Sounders ties. Atlanta United fired former Sounders player and assistant coach Gonzalo Pineda after less than 3 years as head coach. Brian Schmetzer said a return for Pineda wasn't in the cards right now, saying, quote, "I have a great staff too. There's no room now. If someone moves on and Gonzo doesn't have a job, which I think is unrealistic, then of course he's going to get another job here or somewhere else." All right, Seattle Reign FC also in Kansas City this weekend can really make a weekend of it if you're a
The
Seattle
here or
soccer
somewhere
fan.
else is the United States or somewhere else
No,
in the
I think he
world.
meant here with the Sounders.
He just said he's not going to give him a job unless somebody leaves. I think he means here in the MLS or somewhere else in the world.
I mean, I suppose so. It's probably a lot easier to get a job in MLS if you played in MLS.
But it was just like his whole statement was like, yeah, we're not going to hire Gonzalo Pineda. Which one is it, Schmitz?
Oh, wow. Really asking the tough questions of Brian Schmetzer. Somehow this became like a campaign ad. Which is it, Schmetz? You bring it back, Gonzalo Pineda, or not? Again, the Reign, their difficult schedule continues with their trip to Kansas City to face the second place Current. It will be the fifth consecutive Reign game against a team in the top four in the standings. Obviously, they haven't won any of them. A team that has won several lately. Seattle Storm, now riding a five-game winning streak, the longest of Noel Quinn's career as head coach. The longest since they won six straight early in the 2021 season. Noel Quinn actually coached the end of that winning streak, but Dan Hughes was still coaching at the start of it, so it's the longest winning streak of her career. Haven't necessarily been the best opposition they've done it against. It was at home against Indiana, still winless Washington, and then on the road against the Fever again, as well as the Chicago Sky, and then back home against the Phoenix Mercury, who are playing out without Brittany Griner. But at the same time, this is a Storm team that is still coming together with NECA Gwumike and Skylar Diggins-Smith, the latter of whom, since not finishing that game against Indiana, as we talked about last week, has been really playing quite well since that, playing like the all-star that she has been throughout her career. And they also have done it with a little adversity. NECA Gwumike sat out Tuesday's game against Phoenix with an eye injury she suffered in practice the day before. And Storm just rolled on without her. Starting lineup played really well with Mercedes Russell stepping in. Joyner Holmes, who got brought back, as we sort of alluded, was going to happen. at roster cutdown days, they waived Dulcie Finca Mangiato and brought her once her salary fit under the cap. She was the top post off the bench without Agumake and played well. Really just a strong night all around for the Storm. Ezi Megbogor, who signed a one-year contract extension through 2025 on Tuesday afternoon, had one of the better games of her career against Phoenix with 21 points.
Great. I mean, that's kind of all you can ask for a team in this position is to win the games you're supposed to win. So I don't think saying that it's not necessarily the stiffest competition really matters. It's like they're in a position right now that they have to beat all these teams, and they have. And you're also, it's such a small WNBA that it's basically like, that's a huge chunk of the WNBA that you talked about when you're saying this isn't the stiffest competition. You're basically alluding to two or three teams that they haven't beaten during that time period.
Yeah, they've beaten four teams at this point. You'd say they're probably the three of the four favorites to be three of the four teams in the lottery this year. One of the teams in that group probably will make it. So Ezzie's contract extension, 1 year for $186,000, according to Richard Cohen of HerHoopStats.com, which is the most that she could make on an extension, is a 20% raise off her current salary. No surprise, she only went for 1 year. I asked her about this before the game on Tuesday, and she acknowledged that the possibility of the salary cap going way up in 2026 played into this. Basically, only two players in the entire league, other than who aren't on rookie contracts, have signed through 2026.
Really? Who's that?
Kalani Brown of Dallas and Lexi Brown of LA, who are, you know, kind of players who haven't been really very established in the WNBA, and their teams offered them, I think, probably slightly bigger salaries so that they'd sign the 3 year contract.
So the anticipation is, why would you not have signed a 2 year deal then?
Is those players?
No, as Ezi Megbogor. You said 2026.
It's a 1 year extension.
Oh, okay,
so she's currently under contract for now. So this adds 2025 to her
that
contract.
Makes sense. Yes.
And it also aligns her with Skylar Diggins-Smith, signed a 2 year contract coming into this year. Jewel Loyne signed a 2 year extension. All of them are signed through 2025. Neko Ogumike is the one key Storm player who is not having signed a 1 year contract last offseason.
So, I mean, I guess a couple of pieces there are the Storm could look radically different in a couple of years.
I mean, everyone in the league could look radically different. Again, no, like everyone is going to be a free agent. I also don't know. We mentioned that Toronto was coming into the league in 2026. I don't know how they do an expansion draft if no one's under contract.
That's an interesting question. They have one of two players to choose from. Each team gets a player. I mean, do you need to do an expansion draft? Couldn't it just be like, here's some money, go sign free agents?
Well, I mean, that is the thing. Yes, if everyone's a free agent, it's a pretty good situation to come in on. Golden State's coming in next year, so they will have a decent complement of players available.
But if you're Toronto and everybody's a free agent, then you could just go sign free agents and have the whole salary cap to deal with. How much more is the salary cap going to jump? Like, what is the cap right now, and what is the anticipation that it could jump to?
I mean, it'd be way too speculative, but it would not be surprising if it doubled or even more. I guess I would say the current salary cap this year is $1.46 million.
Oh, that it's going to go up so fast.
Yeah,
the salary cap is that, does that increase year over year, or is it only on certain points in the CBA?
It increases year over year, but it's like a modest 3% or something along those terms. So this is going to be, it's going to be like the NBA cap spike in the WNBA.
The NBA cap spike that happened in 2008 or whatever. What year was it?
2016.
16.
It didn't happen like the year the Sonics moved to Oklahoma City. That didn't happen. I don't know if you're aware. A guy leaving Oklahoma City was a key part of the cap spike. You may be familiar with it. Yeah, and it's interesting. Jewel Loyne's one of the players who kind of got caught the last time this happened. It wasn't as dramatic in 2020, I believe, was the first year of the new CBA. But she was still under an extension and ended up making way less than what her maximum would have been that
season.
How
long are the rookie deals? Like, so Caitlin Clark's deal, how long is it?
4 years are the rookie contracts.
So players who just came in this last year won't be able to sign a new deal until 2 years into the cap spike.
Yes, although I would not be surprised if we see this kind of if we see the kind of cap side, because it's also the new TV deals kick in 2026, in addition to the CBA being renegotiated potentially. I would expect they would adjust those deals to some extent.
They might just
I mean, they're not going to make
adjust
them
them up.
free agents, but yeah, I think they could adjust them up. There's some precedent for that in the NBA.
For rookies in this time period, like, are we going to see basically nobody come out in the 2025 draft because they're all going to wait? Are like the rookie deals are also going to be good, or is it better to get a year closer to free agency?
I think that's probably a reason that they would have to adjust it. Not as many, now that the COVID years are largely done, not as many players are going to have the option to come back. There still be a few potentially, but it's not the same.
You're saying that everybody had flexibility basically during the COVID years or
Correct. I mean,
because
there's still
of
like
COVID
Paige
years.
Bueckers hypothetically could come back in 2025, 26 if she wanted to, but then for a sixth year of eligibility, but that would be a little surprising.
She's coming out next year.
Yeah.
Interesting. I do feel like the WNBA, like right now, if you were to ask me what the most relevant sport in the United States is, what is the most prominent sport in the United States? I feel like it's the WNBA more than anything else.
There's sure a lot of discourse right now.
Do you have any perspective on the discourse?
I yes. Would I rather would I prefer to share it? I would not. So Tuesday night's game also doubled as the start of the WNBA Commissioner's Cup this season for the Storm. They've changed that format a little bit, like the NBA, to separate those games out in the schedule. And basically, your first five games of the month of June are going to be your Commissioner's Cup against the five other teams in the Western Conference. Point differential is an important tiebreaker in a lot of these scenarios. So that the Storm getting an 18-point win against Phoenix was a big deal from that standpoint. Now, the challenge is, number one, they play three out of their five Commissioner's Cup games on the road. And worse than that, number two, they play the two best teams in the Western Conference, Las Vegas and Minnesota, both on the road in this upcoming road trip. They'll play at Vegas on Friday night, the first time this season they face the Aces, the two-time defending champs, and then Sunday at Minnesota, who they lost to home and home to start the season, although the loss on the road coming in double overtime. Then back home to take on LA, the first time Cam Brink will be coming back to the Pacific Northwest as a pro.
After those Commissioner's Cup games, do they move to the tournament after that?
It's
A
just a
playoff one?
one-off game. The final is scheduled for January or January, June 25th.
Got it. So it's just one team from there. That's why point differential is so important.
Exactly. So if there's, three teams that finish tied, for example, then and they all beat each other, then the point differential in those tied games becomes the next tiebreaker.
All right.
Our UW softball. Scott Hansen of the Seattle Times wrote a piece about the transfers, which now also include catcher Sydney Stewart and reserve outfielder Brooklyn Carter, but couldn't get any players or Heather Tarr to comment. Did explain that Tarr's tweet, quote, "It's a great day to be a dog," could have referenced rumors of her departure, which had not reached us. So that was an interesting thing. UW women's basketball, a big time recruiting addition. Five-star recruit from Colfax, Brynn McGahee, announced her commitment to UW in the class of 2025, where she's currently ranked number 17 in the ESPN rankings. The other finalists in her recruiting were Duke, Iowa, UCLA, and Utah.
Wow.
Yeah, Huskies beat out a pair of Big Ten foes.
Where is Colfax?
That's a great question. Hold on, let me read the quote first before I reference this.
Okay.
McGahee told 247sports.com, "I never wanted to stay in Washington, and I wasn't planning on it until I took my visit. From there, I knew that's where I wanted to be. Early on and up until my visit, I wanted to go out of state and have a far experience, but it's still 6 hours away. Staying home really wasn't a factor in why I committed there."
So you want me to guess where Colfax is?
I do want you to guess where Colfax is,
I'm
but I
guessing
also like
it's
kind of a flex for Tina Langley that it's like she built the fence around the state of Washington, but it was against around like it wasn't an easy sell. It was actually she was working uphill to keep her at home.
it's kind of a strange quote. I never wanted to stay in Washington. I wasn't planning on it until I took my visit.
She had no idea what Seattle looked like before she got
No, I was like, what happened? I've been to UW a lot of times. No point have I been that inspired.
No, you have agreed to go to UW, though.
Like, I had very few choices. My other options were also in Western Washington. I guess Central. But I'm going to guess that Colfax is, like, south, deep southeast Washington.
Yes, I think that's fair. It's near Pullman is actually where it is.
Oh, okay. So it's norther.
I mean,
I have never once heard of the city.
I've definitely heard of Colfax.
I thought it might have been Canada when you said it at first.
I would have assumed that Colfax was somewhere along I-90 was my assumption before.
Oh,
I
yeah, it's south. Okay. Well, Pullman's a lot further south than I thought.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, look, we can't all be the Tri-Cities. We can't all be Walla Walla.
Yeah,
we
Colfax
can't all be Vancouver, Washington.
Shockingly close to Pullman. It's right, you know, there on the Palouse.
You know the thing about Colfax?
What?
Still way north of Toronto.
It is. Looking at this picture on Google Maps of Colfax, I understand why she was so impressed by Seattle, Washington.
Oh, no. She must have gone to Seattle for like AAU tournaments or something.
I don't know. If you've just been to Colfax, honestly, there's some parts of Colfax in these photos that look pretty lovely. But yeah,
I
mean,
look, I assume you've got rolling hills of the Palouse out there as well.
There actually are rolling hills and they look beautiful. But oh, look at that sunset in Colfax. Anyway,
Tristan's vacationing in Colfax this year. Alone in Colfax.
Well, I mean, if some of the other options were Iowa also.
UCLA, I got to say, the wild card in that group. UCLA is crushing it. I don't know if you've seen. They're, like, loaded for next year along with USC. All right, a little UW men's basketball news. They will play in the Acrisure Invitational at the home of the Coachella Valley Firebirds.
Whoa!
During Thanksgiving
weekend. Our favorite
weekend.
Team? Hello. I love a Thanksgiving tournament, by the way. Every year.
Do
just
you?
Give a... Do I?
They play on Thanksgiving Day at 3:30 p.m.
Ooh.
It's like, hey, I was going to sit down to dinner and enjoy a little UW men's basketball action.
It's that time of year where you're just like, oh yeah, UW men's basketball is happening right now.
I like when they play like the Friday night after Thanksgiving.
We're playing Oregon in football that Saturday, right?
That sounds right.
Okay. But there was
definitely. I looked at
Day.
The schedule, and it just looks weird to have Oregon in that
position. At the end. I kind of like it having them there.
I mean, it is nice to have our biggest rival there.
But we would just always play Oregon, like, you know, the most important game at random times every year. There was never a set time. But there was this was. Last year or no 2 years ago on Thanksgiving that it was like it's like 11 or 9 o'clock or something.
Oh,
which feels like
a 10 p.m. start time.
It was crazy late, right? And that was Thanksgiving Day, wasn't it?
It was. I was driving from our aunt and uncle's house in Puyallup down to Portland for the full night tournaments and made it in time to see the second half of the Huskies beating St. Mary's.
That was the victory over St. Mary's, kind of their signature win at that point. So
Such
having that
win
one
of what
of the season, wasn't that kind of like the best win?
It was.
So that was their signature win of the season. They had happened on Thanksgiving Day. I mean, the reason that they got the number one seed way back when they got the number one seed was that Thanksgiving tournament that they won. So
I mean, Utah and Andrew Bogut, I believe.
Was that really they beat Utah in that tournament? I remember they beat Alabama. Say somebody like Alabama or Texas
I think that's,
A&M.
That sounds right as well.
Yeah. And that was in Alaska, right? That was in Fairbanks.
Yeah, that was the old, I don't know if it was the top of the world still or the other one, but it was definitely in Alaska. They beat Utah in the opener on Thanksgiving night, Oklahoma on Friday, Black Friday, and Alabama on Saturday.
Wow.
In the final.
Look at this. I'm remembering Joey Estes starts, Alabama victories from 2004. You've got to give it up. The Ginkgo biloba is working. But
yes, MVP material.
But those are some of the best wins that we have Thanksgiving Day. 3:30 p.m., not so sure about that. I like it at like an 8 p.m., which, yes, again, 8 p.m. on Thanksgiving might as well be 4 a.m. It is the latest time on the face of the earth, 8 p.m. It's like Christmas Day and Thanksgiving Day. I don't think I've made it through a Christmas evening without being asleep by like 6 o'clock. In fact, I remember this year falling asleep during, it was the Ravens-Niners game, was on Thanksgiving Day, and I was sound asleep during that one. I like woke up to check the score, and I'm like, good news, and then back to sleep.
On Christmas Day? I was going to say on Thanksgiving Day.
That was Christmas.
Hopefully you stayed awake on Thanksgiving night. Well, maybe not, actually. Didn't go great.
Very happy that the Seahawks are not playing on every single holiday this year. It was not fun.
Anyways, on Thanksgiving Day at 3:30 p.m., the Huskies will face Colorado State, which retained Nico Medved as head coach after winning 25 games last season, including beating UW in Las Vegas. The Rams split with Danny Sprinkle's Utah State team, each winning at home. The winner of that game plays Friday against the winner of Santa Clara and TCU. And you might recall TCU lost to Utah State in the opening round of the NCAA tournament in March.
There we go. So part of the lore.
Some Sprinkle reunions potentially on tap in this one. All right, UW football, as promised. We learned times for the non-conference games. There will be a classic 8 p.m. kickoff against Weber State on August 31st.
Honestly, here's the thing. I saw that start time, and sometimes that game in particular is so brutally hot because they're usually like 3, 4 p.m., and you just roast in the sun. They're up by a million points, and you're like, it turns out I actually hate this team because I'm just way too hot right now. So I think an 8 p.m. start is low-key kind of clutch for that game.
I would say like 6 or 7 is ideal. 8's a little late, but yes, I take your point on that. 12:30 p.m. versus Eastern Michigan the following week, and then 12:30 p.m.
That might be the roasting game.
That will be. Yeah. For the Apple Cup to air on Peacock, much to the consternation of Husky fans everywhere.
Husky fans are like, literally, they're all 65 plus. There's no young generation of Husky fans. We're like spring chickens compared to Husky fans, and a game being on Peacock was too much. Wasn't
I would
it
say
the same with the Michigan's literally Peacock last year, right?
It was, yes. And no, that one, fewer Husky fans were in attendance. I of course was there in Lansing. We will be at the Apple Cup, so the Peacock will not matter to us.
It's the Apple Cup or whatever. Like, I understand that it's more prominent, like it's more important here, but the world kept turning when the game was on Peacock.
It is true.
It's also, we're no longer a Mariners podcast, but you could blame the Mariners.
Oh, yes. For start time?
Yeah. They also announced the start time. I thought this was interesting. I don't think this is a Big Ten thing, but the USC game, I was like, Vince Staples announced a show, and I was like, oh, I wonder if UW is playing that game. And the USC game, they've announced it as, I think it's 12:30 or 1 or 4. It's locked in to not be late. And I was like, great news for Vince Staples. Not, yes, for Vince, he'll be fine. But like, it's a TV show and everything. But great news for us going to go see Vince Staples after that they've already announced those times.
Especially like the inverse of what you're saying. The night game is actually so awful in November. So yes, love that it's going to be no later than 4:30 p.m.
Yeah, no, I thought that was great.
All right, so you mentioned this at the top. Preseason FPI is out from ESPN Analytics, and I left it blank, intentionally blank. Have you looked at it?
I have, yes.
I was going to have you guess.
If you think I'm not on that college football Reddit, you're tripping.
No, that's true. I saw it on Twitter.
College football is like my number one sport now. The Huskies being good these last 2 years has elevated my hatred for Oregon, the state, the team, everything is at like, it's never been higher or whatever. And college football is, to me, it is, again, the Transact was too good because the teams transacted conferences.
All right, Huskies number 31 in preseason FPI, 6th in the Big Ten, 3rd among new schools behind Oregon and USC. I think this is the ballpark of where I expected. Like 25th would be about the highest I think I would reasonably expect for the Huskies, given the transfer, the losses to the NFL and a handful of transfers.
I think people are maybe a little bit over, or Oregon is number 2, right?
In the Big Ten, or
no, overall.
Were they? No, I didn't catch that.
I believe Oregon was, they were extraordinarily high. I think people might be slightly overrating Oregon. This is not even as a hater talking. Like, I get the Dylan Gabriel transfer, but the amount of players that they had drafted in the first four rounds of the draft, that sometimes it's hard to remake your roster that quickly.
It's intriguing how many of the teams ranked ahead of Alabama have coaches that passed ongoing to Alabama. It's Oregon, and then Sark at Texas is number three.
I don't know if you saw this or if this really matters, but I thought this was an interesting bit. Brett McMurphy tweeted, NBC's preferred primetime lineup, sources told Action Network, which I don't exactly know what, I don't know if these are chosen yet. And I get that UW is probably more likely to be in primetime just because of time zones. So there's one game per week. It was Michigan at UW, October 5th. USC at UW, November 2nd. And then Oregon at UW, November 30th. Well, that's actually in Oregon. But seeing that many games that feature UW in the preferred primetime lineup for NBC, vis-a-vis if you look at some of the kind of like blue bloods of the Big Ten, it showed to me the value that teams like UW and Oregon are bringing. And also a little bit how absurd it is that they're having to take that smaller portion of the TV deal for that first period. Like, I understand that it's not as national of a brand as, say, a USC is, but both just regionally by being able to fill that West Coast time slot, like, these were massive additions to the Big Ten. And I think it's kind of where they ranked FPI-wise, which is you have your blue bloods of the Big Ten, right? Penn State, Michigan, Ohio State, and then Oregon, USC, and then UW. And it's kind of like, I feel like pecking order wise in the Big Ten, that's about where things rank. Is they're not part of that elite tier necessarily, but right behind it, and in the top team right behind it, ahead of, say, like a Wisconsin or a Michigan State.
Yeah. I mean, those schools are also relatively down right now compared to where they have been in the not so distant past. But if there were still a Big Ten West, it would be less likely to produce such fodder for the winner of Michigan-Ohio State under the current setup.
I mean, if you can imagine, like, Oregon being in there, obviously, is that they're number one ranked by FPI. So FPI considers them a better team than Ohio State or Michigan.
Correct. I found it amusing. My ESPN colleague Neil Payne wrote the story accompanying the release and pointed out Florida and Washington moving in opposite directions. And actually, people at UW are like, awesome, because don't want that Florida job opening up for Jen Fish.
Well, I think the issue with that is it's not necessarily that Florida and UW are moving up. They are, FPI-wise. However, are you aware of Florida's schedule?
I am aware of Florida's schedule.
So if you look at the projection of games won, Florida's FPI might not be that bad, but they also might just lose a bunch of games because of how difficult the schedule is. So if that's the thing that you're nervous about, it doesn't look great.
Oh, yes, they have them projected 6-6 on average.
So it's kind of like your FBI is fine, but ultimately the schedule is going to dictate that. And I don't think that fans of Florida are going to be like, well, the FBI was good, but we still lost 6 games.
I agree that is likely going to be the case. But if UW doesn't have a great season, then maybe Jed Fish is a little bit less attractive of a candidate.
That's not what we're cheering for. We're not going to be in a position of not wanting a good season because we're afraid that our coach will leave.
But we got to be okay having a not great season.
I agree. Be okay not having a great season. We understand this is a transitional year, but we shouldn't be like, let's be happy about it because then Jed Fish isn't going to leave. Because it's sort of like, then Jed Fish might not be that good of a coach.
I mean, I think UW can have a down season and Jed Fish can still be that good a coach. It's all fine.
I also think people slightly overrate players. Like Dan Lanning, bunch of Alabama history, right? no history on the West Coast at all at Oregon. I get that he has the number one team in FBI, so the chances of leaving there for Alabama.
Number two.
They're number two. Who is one? Sark?
Georgia.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if you're familiar with their work.
So it's Georgia, Oregon, Texas, Bama.
Correct. Bama's actually fifth.
Okay.
Ohio State is ahead of them as well.
Got it. But I think people overrate having attended a school as the only reason that somebody would want to go there. And look, maybe Jed Fish would.
I do agree.
But it's kind of like, it's almost a little bit too simple. And if Jed Fish is good enough, job, I don't think he's going to be like, well, I can move my family back across the country again for a job that might be less appealing than the UW job if they're in the position where he was good. Because for him to be good enough at UW, they're going to be close to in the conversation for the playoff to instantly be like, we'll give you the Florida job after a year, pay the buyout, et cetera, et cetera. It's kind of like, if this keeps happening at Washington, maybe it's a good enough job that you would stay at it. So I'm going to go ahead and just hope that UW wins games and not be worried about whatever the fuck happens in Florida.
That's probably the right position to take.
I mean, also, it just doesn't matter. You could be worried about it. Literally nothing we do affects it.
It's true. on that Peltoncast nihilism.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.